Librarian Nancy Pearl is with us again. She joins us regularly to talk about under-the-radar reads, as she calls them, books she thinks are deserving of more attention than they've been getting. And she sent us a hefty news stack just in time for the summer reading season. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Steve.
You've sent us on this stack here a book called Snapper. And I'm very excited that you sent this book because I see that it's been reviewed at NPR.org by our own colleague Petra Mayer, who includes the line, "Snapper is a love letter to the state of Indiana."
Oh, I might disagree with that a little bit. I think it's a love letter to learning how to accept what happens in your life. It's about a young man, Nathan Lockmuller, who gets a job studying birds in and around Evansville, Indiana. The book is then composed of a series of interconnected short stories about Nathan's life. You get a picture of Nathan from the time he's a teenager to the time he's in his middle 30s awaiting the birth of his first child. And the two through lines that pull the stories together are his love for this unattainable woman that he meets when he's in college named Lola, and also his great love of birds. It's gorgeously written. I just wanted to read a really short passage. In this passage, he's comparing the oven bird to the Kentucky warbler. And he says, "If you do spot the oven bird away from her nest, she pretends her wing is broken and hops along the nearest ravine, hoping you will follow. The Kentucky warbler is more sadistic. She doesn't feign injury, but she leads you away from the nest until you are ankle deep in mud or rattlesnakes or both. The only way you will find her nest is if she shows you, and she won't show you if she knows you are there. It's like staking out the girls' shower block at summer camp. It can be done, but it takes skill."
Oh, you got to watch out for those Kentucky warblers in life. You have also sent us a book called Keeping the Castle. What's that about?
Keeping the Castle is a book that is marketed to teens. Patrice Kindle, the author, has made her name writing for teens. But this is the kind of book that has great crossover appeal to adults, especially adults who love Jane Austen. This is a young woman who is, in this case, holding her family together. She has two stepsisters who are kind of wicked. Her mother is pretty ineffectual, and they live in a very crumbling castle on, I think, on the edge of the North Sea, but okay, it's never made exactly clear where this is. And the next castle over, a new family comes to live there, and they have two non-married young men of just the right age. And of course, one is dashing and funny and handsome, and the other is a little bit snarky and not somebody you would want to be interested in. And she has to sort of maneuver her way to try to marry the handsome, dashing man. And then, of course, life intervenes and shows her that things are not always as they appear to be.
Now, lots of people have written in the style of Jane Austen, but are there dangers in trying to attempt this form from another century?
I think that the major difficulty is trying to get the same tone that Austen had and how hard that is. She's made it look so easy, and it's very hard to get that exact wryness and humor and these little tart observations that she makes in Pride and Prejudice. But I think in this, sure, you're going to find differences. It isn't Jane Austen, but it's one of the closest things to Jane Austen that I've read.
Well, let's move on in our selection here. You've also got on the stack a book called A Tangle of Knots by Lisa Graff.
It's a perfect book for middle grade readers for summer reading. And the main character is a young orphan named Katie. Mm-hmm. And she has no idea who her parents are. And she comes to live above the Lost Luggage Emporium in this strange city. And there she meets a lot of odd and interesting people, all of whom seem to have something to do with her background. And so in this quest to find out who she really is, we move forward in the plot, rooting for Katie all the time. The other wonderful thing about this book, and the reason it has pride of place on my bookshelves at home, is that after many chapters, there are recipes for the most luscious sounding cakes that you will ever know. And that's because everybody in this world that Lisa Graff, the author, has made up has a special talent. And Katie's talent is cake baking. And I was so tempted when I would get to one of those recipes to put the book down and go make the cake.
That sounds great. And really, you had me at Lost Luggage Emporium. What a great metaphor for a kid who's looking for her parents and for her identity.
Isn't that
That's
wonderful?
Really tremendous. It's really great. Let's do one more if there's time. Timothy Hallinan, Crashed.
Oh, my gosh. If you're looking for a mystery with a fresh new hero, then you want to run right out and get the book Crashed. It's the first in a new series that features a burglar named Junior Bender. In addition to being a burglar, he is a fixer for other criminals when they get in trouble. So Junior Bender gets more or less blackmailed into working for one of the crime bosses in Los Angeles. And it's the tone for me that makes this book. And here's just an example. He's talking to the person who's going to send him to this mob boss. She's kind of the middle person. And she says, if it weren't for your constant focus on negative energy, your marriage might have gone better. God, the things.
I love it already. Go on, please.
And then it goes on. God, the things women think they have the right to say. My marriage went fine, I said. It was before the marriage went that was difficult. So this is a book, I mean, if you have a plane trip to take, this is the book to grab.
Nancy Pearl is the author of many books with the phrase book lust in the titles. You can find all of her Under the Radar recommendations at NPR.org and get the latest news from NPR Books. Follow them on Twitter at NPR Books. You can also follow this program at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Renee Montaigne. And Steve, you'll be spending the summer writing your own book. So just want to say we'll miss you here on the show.
Thanks. I'll be back as soon as I can.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The kendama is a simple toy, a painted wooden ball attached to a wooden stick by a piece of string. Kendamas are traditional in Japan, and while they're not popular all over the U.S., there is a kendama craze on the West Coast. As part of our series about media for kids, Ben Adler of Capital Public Radio sent this story from Sacramento, a city that kendama vendors call a hotspot.
Instead of me telling you what a kendama is, let's turn to an expert.
It has a ball with a string.
That's 9-year-old Logan Tosta, who lives in a Sacramento suburb.
And there is a stick that has 3 cups and a spike.
Each cup is a different size on a different side of the stick.
One is called big cup, one is small cup, and one is base cup. And the spike is just called spike.
You hold the stick's handle, swing the ball in the air, and try to catch it any way you can.
And the ball has a hole in it so that the ball can catch it on the spike.
That's way harder than landing it in one of the cups. Logan Tosta says it took him about a day to learn his first trick, a month to learn how to do spike. Now he can do tricks with names like airplane, jumping stick, and UFO, flipping the stick to catch the ball in different ways.
What's your record for a number of consecutive...
200 of these, back and forth, just like this.
From big cup to base cup.
Yes. 200 of them.
Kendamas seem to be the buzz these days at elementary schools all around Sacramento. My kindergartner knew all about them. He said his friends have them. Now he does too. But kendamas aren't that easy to find. They're usually at comic stores or online. And they aren't cheap. The one I bought cost about $17. Which is why a few weeks back, Tosta was invited by his family friend to visit a school where she teaches second grade. Francis Swanson's school is in a low-income neighborhood of Sacramento. Her students have all heard of kendamas, but they don't have them.
So this is Logan.
Hi, Logan.
And Logan is here to show you some tricks with the kendama because he's actually won contests before.
The kids were riveted.
Look at his ears already. I can't get my eyes off of my eyes. Wait, look at this.
And then came the big surprise. He raised money from family and friends to give kendamas to every kid in the class.
That is awesome. Oh my gosh, what do you guys say?
Thank you!
And with that, the students swarm over to grab their new favorite toy. No batteries, no screen, no apps, just a wooden ball attached to a wooden stick with a string.
I got it!
For NPR News, I'm Ben Adler in Sacramento.
From a mythical sea creature to a real one now, octopus. The Greeks have caught and cooked octopus since ancient times. On the islands, where the catch is usually fresh, octopus is grilled over charcoal and seasoned with sea salt and fresh lemon. As part of our summer series, The Global Grill, Joanna Kakissis sent this postcard from a place that specializes in octopus.
The village of Perdika is in the south of Aegina, an island of pistachio trees just off the coast of Athens. On a hot summer day, people in shorts and sundresses stroll along the tiny village port that's lined with sailboats. And just above that port are the Psaro Tavernas, the fish tavernas. The busiest one is called Miltos, a whitewashed little place with blue doors. A street musician with a sunburned face plays a folk song on his clarinet. He stops at every table, serenading local families, Spanish tourists, and me and two journalist friends from Athens. A young waiter runs through the menu. Sea urchin salad, fish roe dip, sardines, red mullet, and octopus. The grilled octopus is especially good, he says. He motions over his shoulder to a man with a bushy mustache and a graying ponytail. That's Spiros Nikolaidis, the grill master here. He's sprinkling sea salt on foot-long octopus tentacles cooking on a hot charcoal grill. I stare at a sizzling tentacle. How long does it take for that to cook, I ask. 30 minutes, maybe 45, he says. It depends on how much sun it's taken in. He points to the tavern's rooftop terrace. Two pink octopi, or is it octopuses, are hanging like shirts on a clothesline. I walked to the terrace with Miltiades Trimis, or Miltos for short. He used to travel the world as part of the Greek merchant marine. Then he settled down on Aegina and opened his fish taverna in 1987. We get the fish straight from the fishermen's boats, he says. Fresh fish grilled right away is always delicious. But octopus is more complicated. After trapping and killing an octopus, a fisherman must slap the carcass on a rock up to 100 times. That's one way to wring out the water. If the octopus is too wet, Trimi says, it will taste rubbery when grilled. So we have to dry the octopus in the sun, he says. We hang it on the clothesline first thing in the morning and don't take it down until evening.
Cheers.
We raise our glasses of white wine and our grilled octopus arrives. The tentacles are cut into 1-inch pieces and served with lemon. This is the first time my friend Deepa has even tasted octopus.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I thought it'd be more rubbery than it is. It's kind of crunchy and chewy at the same time, if that makes any sense. It's been grilled very well and it's just, you know, light and refreshing at the same time. And it'll go down really well with this wine.
The grill master, Spiros Nikolaidis, adds more tentacles to the fire. He's been grilling octopus for 17 years, but he says he's actually repulsed by the idea of tasting it. I won't eat octopus, he says. I will eat anything but octopus. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis.
This is NPR News.
Coming this weekend, it will be exactly 100 days until people can begin signing up for health insurance coverage under the new federal health law. It also will mark the launch of an enormous public relations effort to find people eligible for new coverage and urge them to sign up when the time comes. Still, like everything else about the health law, even this seemingly innocuous effort has been touched by controversy. Here's NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner.
Somewhere around 30 million Americans will be eligible to enroll in state health insurance exchanges beginning October 1st. But there's a big problem, says Ann Filippik. Lots of those people don't know it.
Our research showed that it was about 78% of the uninsured in the country are unaware of these opportunities.
Filippik is president of Enroll America. It's a private nonprofit group whose goal is to help educate the public about the health law's insurance opportunities and how they can take advantage of them. The group is taking a two-pronged approach, says Filippik. On the one hand, it's seeking out people who are already interacting with the healthcare system.
We want to be thinking about how do we have a presence at community health centers or working with organizations that represent doctors to make sure that the word is out so that folks can get the information that they need.
But they also plan to go where people congregate in the community: churches, small businesses, fairs, even farmers markets. One of the key demographics Enroll America will be reaching out to is young adults. They're considered critical to making the health exchanges work and among the most difficult to reach. But Filippik says her group's research has uncovered a secret weapon. For young men, it turns out their most trusted messenger is their mom.
And so part of what we're doing is building a program that is working to get those moms across the country the information that they need.
So far, Enroll America has raised tens of millions of dollars. A lot of that money has come from health industry backers that don't necessarily love the Affordable Care Act. But, says Ron Pollock of the consumer group Families USA, those groups do have a financial interest in getting more people health insurance.
Insurers obviously want to have more clients, and more people have health coverage. That's good business for the insurance industry. For hospitals, they provide a lot of care for people who are uninsured, and that means that the hospital actually does not get paid for those services.
So they, too, would want to participate. Similarly, pharmaceutical firms and drugstores also stand to benefit by having more people covered, and they're helping, too. But Enroll America is getting more attention and more scrutiny since Congress refused to give federal officials more money to promote the health law. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius came under fire earlier this spring for urging companies to donate to the group. This was Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee on Fox News.
Congress has said, we refuse to give you more money to implement Obamacare. And she's saying, well, then if you won't do it, I'll go outside and I will raise private money, use a private organization, and do it anyway.
But Pollock, who chairs Enroll America's board, says Sebelius's actions were hardly scandalous.
This is astounding that this is a controversy. If you look through all the different precedents of what has occurred in the past, you'll see that this is a common thing.
In particular, he cites the Bush administration's 2005 implementation of Medicare's prescription drug benefit, which was and is run by private insurers.
And it was a public-private partnership that involved the Department of Health and Human Services. The secretary played a very active role, Republican secretary, of course, and the pharmaceutical industry.
And starting this weekend, you can expect to hear not just the ongoing debate about the health law, but if Enroll America has its way, a lot more about how it's all going to work. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This spring, readers of the Orange County Register in Southern California started seeing much more coverage of local universities. Less apparent was the fact that the schools were paying for the coverage. Depending on whom you ask, it's either a smart way to bring in revenue or a serious breach of journalism ethics. From member station KPCC, Ben Bergman reports.
Earlier this year, Orange County Register executives offered three schools a deal: pay $275,000 and get a year's worth of weekly sections filled with feel-good features, smiling pictures of students, and guest columns written by faculty. The University of California, Irvine, Chapman University, and Cal State Fullerton all signed on. Fullerton Chief Communications Officer Jeff Cook says the proposal seemed almost too good to be true.
For me to march into a newspaper and say, you should do a section on our university each week, my past experience isn't is one that would indicate that that wouldn't really be an appropriate ask.
Cook was so excited about the Register's offer that he forked over almost all his department's ad budget. The money comes from fees the public university generates. No taxpayer dollars are used. He says Fullerton's operating budget has been slashed by some $40 million over the past few years due to state cutbacks. So it's important to attract private donations.
Part of the process of connecting with donors, of demonstrating that Cal State Fullerton is investment worthy, is presenting them with legitimate points of pride about the institution.
This would be a case study for my class.
Jeffrey Brody was a reporter at the Register for a decade before joining Fullerton as a journalism professor. He says many of his former colleagues share his concern about the arrangement, but they're afraid to speak out.
When I worked as a journalist, it was clear that journalists should refrain from taking even meals from sources. Now we have sources paying for entire sections. I mean, it creates an image of impropriety.
A copy of the contract between the Register and Fullerton obtained by KPCC says the university is expected to actively collaborate with the paper on story ideas. It does make clear, though, that the Register retains final authority on story selection and editing in order to preserve credibility. But Brody says the paper's new owner and publisher, Aaron Kushner, who was formerly a greeting card executive, doesn't understand a basic journalism tenet. There should be a firewall between editorial and advertising.
I wish I could sit down and talk with him and explain, you know, some of the traditions of American journalism.
When we sat down with Kushner, he was unapologetic.
It's a great service for the community.
He said the university sections are among the paper's most popular with readers, and the deal with the schools is hardly news.
Having advertisers in a section that's relevant for both the advertisers and the subscribers isn't a particularly unique model. That is the newspaper model.
He says the arrangement is no different than if a car manufacturer took out ads in the auto section.
Does it color our coverage of those sectors? Not if we're doing our job.
Media critic Tom Rosensteel agrees. The executive director of the American Press Institute says he doesn't see a problem with the arrangement as long as the Register is transparent. But he says readers will be the ultimate judge. Do they feel like they're reading press releases or news stories?
This is all in the execution, you know. Can they do it in a way where they do not harm the credibility and authority of their newsroom?
Rosensteel says as all newspapers struggle to survive amid declining ad sales and readership, they will have to be increasingly creative about finding new sources of revenue. For NPR News, I'm Ben Bergman in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now let's get down to basics. When you brush your hair or your teeth this morning, take a look at the technology in your hand. The brush is so simple you might not even think of it as technology. Flexible fibers sticking out of a handle. And because it's cheap to make, China has grabbed much of the market in making brushes. But in the United States, several hundred small brush factories are hanging on. Marianne McCune of NPR's Planet Money team reports on some of the tricks they use to survive.
In an old-fashioned factory building in the South Bronx, Izzy Kirshner's half a dozen employees are making paintbrushes. They're stuffing bristles from slaughtered boars into metal casings. They're doing it with their hands and machines that once belonged to Kirshner's dad. But unlike his dad, these guys try to make every brush perfect.
My father was more interested in mass production.
Efficiency.
Efficiency, okay.
When Kirshner took over the business about 15 years ago, he saw you couldn't make it if your brush bristles came out in the paint. With China making brushes more efficiently than he ever could, he learned he had to live by survival strategy number one. Produce quality, not quantity, because you can't compete with China on price.
Once you try to do that, you're in trouble.
Instead, sell a brush that paints beautifully to professional painters and give them exactly what they want. That's survival tip number two, adapt to what your customers want. For example, Kirshner makes a specialized brush called the Man Helper, used to paint the Triborough Bridge. He finds niche markets, and there are plenty of niche markets out there. Another brush maker taking advantage of them, Lance Cheney, out of Long Island.
We're making brushes now for the top of the Freedom Tower to keep pigeons out.
That's a $40,000 brush. Cheney is the fourth generation owner of Braun Brush, another little factory with a lot of know-how. Braun Brush made a tiny brush for NASA, for the Mars rover, to sweep away the Martian dirt.
Every day there's another application that surprises me.
Though Cheney's made a name with high-tech brushes, his factory includes machines passed down from his great-grandfather, and some of the employees are nearly that old, too. A man who's been here 51 years uses scissors to snip the ends off a roller brush used to clean Shea Stadium. The plant manager, Adam Chernowski, has been with the company 63 years.
We are not ordinary brush makers. We are problem solvers.
That's the key being able to manufacture in this country. If you have a machine that spits out all of the same thing over and over and over and over again, that's ripe for China. For us, the machine has to be able to be extremely flexible. So it's still automation, but I'm going to make one brush in the morning, another brush between lunch and the break, and then a completely different brush the rest of the day on the same piece of equipment.
Then you can set prices based on perceived value, he says. Not how much the bristle and block cost, but how much time and effort went into it and how much it's worth to the customer.
Do you make any products the cheapest way they can be made?
No.
So high standards and customized products, two strategies that have kept these brush makers in business. And there's a third vital ingredient for both, relationships. They both have loyal customers. But this is where the two brush makers differ. While Cheney keeps building relationships with the next generation, many of Kirshner's clients are from the past. Kirshner's daughter, Deborah, says they love her dad because he's a constant.
They can all get my dad on the phone, and that's just like not how businesses are run anymore.
But what happens when Kirshner, who's 69, and some of his customers start to retire?
I do think that there's probably a little bit of danger in that because it's like there's a lot of loyalty and, yeah, that dies out with people and companies.
There's days where the business feels like it's worth $50 million and there's days where it feels like it's worth 2 cents.
One day soon, Kirshner wants to sell the business. He just needs to find someone who cares as much as he does. Marianne McCune, NPR News, New York.
On Morning Edition from NPR News.